So, Irma, you mentioned last week that the body and the workings of it was a metaphysical system in itself. Mm-hmm. We're wondering, to begin with, if you could talk a little about that.
Partially, we have attacked this. We start as an egg. There's an intelligence center in the egg, and we can demonstrate that the nucleus of the egg is intelligent by cutting it out, and when we do cut it out, the other part of the egg will not develop. On the other hand, if we cut a piece off the egg and don't damage this nucleus, well then this part will be repaired. Which means that the control for the development is in that spot. So we can call that the doorway of intelligence into the cell. The cell, in order to become very complex, has to divide itself, and in order to do so, it must have an intelligent director for each part. So what happens? This center divides itself, half moved up, half down, sets up two centers which then proceed to broadcast impulses, and the two centers build between them a wall. This wall is the same as the firmament mentioned in Genesis. The idea of the firmament is the thing made firm. The actual word in Hebrew gives you the concept of being hammered from two sides, and it's this hammering by the intelligence centers against each other that creates the wall inside the cell. So the generation of an individual cell and the partition of it by the splitting of the intelligence center is a diagram of the whole universe. Now, we can use this diagram for explaining a variety of different things. Suppose we redraw it here and consider one of the aspects of modern psychology in a metaphysical psychologist like Carl Jung. Now, Carl Jung is the greatest metaphysical psychologist of modern times. He differs hardly at all from ancient psychology, and we can actually demonstrate that where he does so, his terminology is becoming a little loose. He's not improving on the original division, but the complex modern terms tend to mislead him in certain ways. It's only about 10, 12 years ago that he really seriously took the alchemical symbology into his system. And in his collected works, probably one of the most interesting volumes is the one on alchemy, as it is full of archaic symbols which he is trying to interpret. Now, you all know the old idea of the iceberg floating in the sea. And the sea represents the unconscious, sentiency without form. The iceberg is showing, say, one-tenth of it, and the rest of it is hidden. Now, this could be a diagram of the whole universe or of an individual within it. If you think of your body as an iceberg, one tiny bit of it is conscious. The greater mass of your being is unconscious, which means not that it is not aware of itself, but that it does not formulate verbally what it is doing. Now, you remember in the Samkhya division we had on the one side the observer and on the other side the observed. We left the observer side completely empty, except for the observer itself, and then we developed down the observed side a prime matter, Prakriti, giving birth to Buddhi, the intellect passing down precipitates the mind, and the interaction between the intellect and the mind produces the ego center. Now, in Carl Jung's psychology we have the similar concept, except we can take the diagram and say here is a focal center just above that line, which we would call the egoic centre, the sense of individual I-ness. All below the line is unconscious. And that egoic centre is not, in Jung psychology, equated with the self. So we have to say the self separately from the ego center. They are not the same. The ego itself is simply the constructed being in consciousness which makes consciousness possible. Remember, we said that consciousness is conscious, it is with seeing. Without form, you have no egoic consciousness. Idea means form. Without an idea, you have not got awareness of yourself as an individual. So that the self includes the whole of your being, the ego does not. The ego is simply that construct inside the self to which you refer in an act of consciousness. The self includes all this zone underneath here, which is unconscious, that is unarticulated, non-verbalized. When you formally see it and name it, it is egoic. And on this surface here, you would use the word persona, the original personality. Persona means through sounding. Person, sonic, through sounding. A stimulus hits the perimeter of your being in the conscious part and produces a formal reaction inside. Another stimulus hits it, and another, and so on, and produces a pattern. Now, insofar as that pattern is created from outside, Jung could call it the persona. It is that which is sounding through you. The reverberations in consciousness are your personality, in his sense of the term. Through sounding means that as the stimulus comes, reverberations go through. Insofar as those reverberations can be attached to the egoic center, then they have an integration point and can build up gradually a proper personality. But underneath it is an unformulated mass. And we'll have to extend this diagram and show there could be another one here, with another egoic center and another personality. And these two would meet on the edge of their personalities, but this underpart, the unconscious, is unconscious in between two. So that we have a collective unconscious here, this mass, all this stuff, which doesn't belong to anybody particularly, and an individual unconscious, this half circle. This half circle represents the individual unconscious of this being, and all the other stuff here is called the collective unconscious. Now, Carl Jung was a modern thinker, and he was trying to think empirically from fact. And he did not fabricate the concept of the collective unconscious from first principles. It was forced upon him by a very simple fact that clinically his patients who came to him under analysis would persist in giving the same kind of replies and doing the same kind of drawings, although they had never met each other. And the drawings in general fell into certain simple categories, and they were remarkably similar to what is called the mandala in Hindu or Tibetan or Chinese psychology. Now, a mandala is simply a circle cut into four parts, and the four parts correspond with the four parts of your being, like the first two divisions of the egg. And in Oriental mystical art, the mandala is simply a circle cut into four parts, in each part of which there is some symbol, a drawing, a man's figure or something, an animal, which represents a certain type of activity within the being. Now, Carl Jung found that these drawings being done by his patients were so similar that he had no alternative but to attribute them to one source. So he said there must be a collective unconscious, so that all this stuff under here that is not within that circumscription, he called the collective subconscious. Now, in the individual unconscious, he said, I put all the things that this egoic center decides are unfit to know about consciously. These are the so-called repressed elements of the individual. So if you have a personality, like a commercial traveler has to have a personality for bringing him into contact with other personalities, and that has to be built up deliberately from the environmental need. If you're in a certain kind of occupation, you deliberately copy the appropriate behaviorisms, the mannerisms of the trade in which you find yourself, and you build up on your perimeter there a series of behavior forms which you call your personality. And you deliberately suppress, drag down, and bury underneath all the things you wouldn't like other people to know about you. So that for every element in the personality shown, there is a corresponding opposite element in your individual unconscious. To use the old analogy of black, white, and grey, man is said to be grey, not black, not white. In some philosophies you get it said that man is fundamentally good, man is white, and if he is not interfered with, everything he does will be right. The opposite school says man is inherently bad, namely existentially he is an egotist, and everything he does will be bad unless you train him. Jung agrees with many of the ancients who say man is potentially able to do anything whatever, and therefore he is not black or white, he is grey. That is to say, he has a middle being in him which is waiting for a stimulus from outside to turn him either darker grey, moving to black, or less dark, moving to the light.
I wonder if I might ask a question here. As you're moving towards a greater integration there, you tend to find more things coming out of this center into consciousness, demanding to be put into action. Things which, if you're not aware of the ability to universalize them, would frighten you.
Yeah.
If they'd say come 2, 3, or 4 years ago, you'd have wondered just what sort of a character you were to have had such ideas.
Yes, well, in general, they cannot come before you're ready to deal with them at some level. Because the whole object is to suppress them prior to your ability to control them. Now, if we can
pull it down the back.
Going the other way.
Yeah.
If we start off again with our circle, and let us do this now in terms of pure logic, and it saves a lot of time. This paper is white, and it's still white in there, and it's white underneath the line I've drawn. The line I've drawn is an arbitrary line drawn by me in order to focus our attention within this circle. So that we say that apart from this arbitrary line drawn by me, if we consider the paper and call that paper the absolute, that is, whatever it is that is at the back of the world as we know it, then it is not dualistic. It is not pluralistic. But the moment I draw a line on it, it appears that there are two. Namely, one inside, finite, one outside, infinite. Now, every circle that is drawn upon it, whether inside that first circle or outside it, is drawn upon the same paper. And that paper represents the absolute. And therefore, all these divisions, whatever and wherever they may occur, are not called real, because we call the real that which is absolutely indestructible. Insofar as a thing is destructible, we say that it is not real. So if you say of a baby, is a baby really human? You say, well, not really, because it will grow up a bit. When is it really human? 21, 28, and so on. It is difficult to pin it. The human contains all these things within itself. And it is only the whole that cannot be broken. And in order to avoid being broken, it must not exist. Remember, existence is existere, out of six, and implies a wheel. Now, unless we draw this line, we cannot say there is an existential being. There's one, there's another, and there's another. This one is included in that one, and that one is excluded from that, but it's still inside this. So when we come to consider just what is the nature of an existence, we can only say that it is a circumscribed zone of the absolute. And we have in no sense altered the quality of the paper internal to the line we have drawn. So we say that the internal absolute, we call that spirit immanent, and the external absolute are the same. They're fundamentally identical. Man's claim to spirituality rests upon this fact, that the rotation here, this line which I've drawn, is really unreal. That is to say, when we draw it to make it what we call real in the existential world, we are introducing something that is not permanent, in the sense that we can rub the line off again. Now, in fact, all existential beings, all finite beings, are made by the rotation of power. And the power itself is a dynamic aspect of the absolute. It is not separable from the absolute, except in thought. The absolute is, from one point of view, power. From another point of view, it is spatial substance. From another point of view, it is the cause of the world. From another point of view, it is absolute transcendence. We change the point of view and we change the name, but we're dealing always with the absolute. When the power rotates, it circumscribes a zone, and that zone we then call an individual being. And yet it has exactly the same quality of paper inside it that it has out. So the qualities of the absolute inside you are identical with the qualities of the absolute outside you. Outside you is for God, if you are inside the universe, that's God. And outside God is the Godhead. So when we talk about God immanent, we mean inside the circumscription. When we talk about God transcendent, we mean outside the circle. There's God transcendent. He goes right across all divisions. Transcendent means going right across all the divisions. And when we go outside, we find something identical in quality with that which is inside. The spirit of man, the free will of man, is no more springing from within of the impulse in this diagram from the paper, which is identical with the paper outside the boundary. So the inner spirit of man has exactly the same qualities as the transcendent spirit of God. And when we come to consider Carl Jung's diagram, it's not his diagram, Carl Jung's thought, in relation to this diagram, if we don't draw anything at all, we could say that is the transcendent self. The transcendent self, the Sanskrit term for it is the Atman. Remember, that is the man-eater, out of meat comes forth meat. Represented here by plain paper. But if we leave it at that, all we have is transcendence. And we cannot discuss without introducing duality. Discuss is D, two, cuss, strike. Discuss means strike two together. So we'll have to draw two. Now, first of all, we will draw one. That's the big circle. And then we have two. One in and one out. Now we can discuss this one and this one, at the perimeter they will strike. The force from outside transcendence hits onto this boundary. The force from inside is the counterstroke to it. One of the titles of Christ in alchemical, mystical philosophy is the counterstroke to God. He presses from the center to the perimeter, while the transcendent absolute is pressing on to this perimeter to keep him in being. If this transcendent doesn't press on this and he does press, it will expand. And it will expand infinitely and become identical with the absolute, in which case there will be no world. So there must be a certain amount of pressure from outside the circle, a certain amount of pressure inside the circle. Now, Jung is not dealing with this transcendence concept because he's not clear about the meaning of this circumscription. So when he talks about the collective unconscious, he's talking about the bottom half of this circle that isn't transcendent because it is collective. Now, collective implies you gather together some parts. And before we drew on this paper, the paper has no parts. The paper is just paper, a pure continuum. To introduce the concept of part, we must first of all make a zone of circumscription, then divide it, and we have the top part, the bottom part. Now, inside this collective subconscious, which is existential, that is to say, it is circumscribed, there are a series of other circles, like this, which are, for Carl Jung, the individuals. All of them have a little part below of the unconscious and the part above of the conscious. I've drawn it equal here because in actual fact, in the logical diagram, we must posit 50% either side of the line for certain reasons we'll see in a moment when we come to deal with what repression is, because a baby doesn't have repression at all. Repression is an attempt to force out of consciousness undesirable elements that would clash with social necessity. So here is an individual unconscious belonging to that being. There is another one belonging to the next being. And here is the collective unconscious. And it is not outside this circumscription. So Carl Jung's psychology is concerned with existence. And there is something outside the circle which we do not call existent because it is not rotating. This is called the absolute. This is the existential collective subconscious of the whole of life. He would say the whole of man's predecessors, whatever they were, from the most simple single cell right through the plant world, the animal world, through the lower forms of life to anthropoid types, and accepting the hypothesis of evolution, he would say that the whole of man's ancestors are inside there as a collective, unconscious record of everything that man's ancestors have done, from the amoeba right up to man. Biologically, he would try to prove it by saying that the germ cells inside human beings are always carried from generation to generation. Only some of them become children, and in order to do so, they must cut in half. Always half of the germ cell is saved for the next generation, which is a biological proof that the first human being's tissue is still in our body. I'm going to make this quite clear. Supposing here's the original egg, which mutated into the line called human. And a portion of it, we'll draw it schematically there, as if half of it were made for sex, for reproduction, and the other half is kept for your individual use. And then we'll take this and bend it round and enclose the bottom half in here and call that the sex cells. Now, when a new child is to be made, a portion of that is taken out and develops and cuts itself in half and uses half to make a body in the same way the first one did, and that's cut in half and comes out. So always there's a half and a half and a half, so that you have inside you some of the actual tissue that Adam had in him in the germplasm itself. And this is a physiological fact. We have in us the physical evidence that we have a collective unconscious in our physical tissue. The fact that we're born human instead of looking like marsupials or butterflies means that we have certain generative forms in us which we call human. These come through the germ cells in the body, and those germ cells never become wholly individuated and die, but they always pass on to the next one through the child. So we say that the original tissue of Adam is persisting now in every human being now alive, and through that tissue the whole of human hereditaments, the whole of human experience is involved into your body at some point. This is why it is possible physiologically to learn to remember what some people would call their own previous incarnations, which are the memories of their ancestors whose tissue is identical with their own, and which tissue, if they're really conscious, they can say is my tissue. As much as Adam could say it is my tissue, so Cain and Abel could say it is my tissue. Because the question of saying is it mine or yours is a question of self-consciousness and nothing else, because property means the ownness of a being. When you are conscious of your tissue to the point where it will do as you say, it is proper to you. It is your property. If it won't do as somebody else tells it to do, and it does as you tell it to do, it is your property. If it won't do as you tell it to do, but it does as somebody else tells it to do, completely, it is their property. That's why the mystics always say, spirit is yours if you use it. It is not if you don't. So we've got here now the Jungian system of psychology inside the absolute. And by using these circumscriptions in the diagram, we can deal with this concept within the larger absolute issues. Inside each one of those, above the line in the light, is an egoic center, and round it is its persona, which you could call its point of reaction with its environment. Now, it is said that if the egoic center is totally identified with its personality, we have a superficial man. That is to say, if all you know about yourself is constituted by the series of tricks that you play on other people to keep up the facade, well then, necessarily you're being very superficial. And that kind of person is the kind of person that breaks down most easily. We'll see mechanically why in a moment. We have to be quite clear that the persona here is your superficial reaction to the environment, determined by the necessity of adjusting yourself to other beings in the world. You have an egoic center inside yourself, which you should be conscious of, and which you are conscious of when you say, it is I who am drinking this tea. And also you have an individual unconscious full of repressed elements, which have been repressed because they are not acceptable in your relations with other beings. So we must be quite clear about this. We have an external, superficial, conceptual self or selves. It may be plural, because a man may have a job playing a piano in a pub on Saturday night, and he may also play the organ on a Sunday night, and he may work for the rest of the week at a totally different job. And he has three sets of reactions, one for each environment. Now, if he knows that he's putting it on each occasion, he is safe. But if he doesn't know, then he has three uncoordinated personalities. This is the case in schizophrenia, where we have this multiple personality problem, which isn't difficult if you see that each personality is no more than a complex of behaviors which are the reactions to specific environments. So you behave in one way in church and in another way at a football match. As long as you know it, what we call healthy people know it. The fellow says, don't do that, this is a football ground, don't so on, you're not in church. He can tell the difference. But with some people, when they go to the football match, they deliberately suppress totally that they ever go to church. And this causes a lesion in parts of the soul and in the physical tissue also, ultimately, of the brain. So that it becomes zoned nervously, so there's no interrelation between the personality that goes to the football match The one that goes for a drink at night, the one that goes to the Sunday school to take his little boy, make him good, and so on. All these are different personalities, and if there are no linked factors, you haven't got one homogeneous, unified human being there. You've got as many beings as there are subsidiary personalities, plus the ego, plus the totality of his collective unconscious individual, and a background of the collective unconscious, and behind that the absolute. So you've got quite a lot underneath.
And in the unconscious, you say that's repressed because it would go against his relations with society.
Yeah.
Surely he must have articulated that at some time to repress it.
Not necessarily verbally, you see. You can do it on a dog. Remember what we said about the dog? If the dog wets on the carpet and you smack the dog and point to it and then put it out, afterwards, if you come in and somebody spills a little bit of tea there and you think the dog has done it and say, who's done that? He looks guilty. And runs away. Now, he hasn't verbalized anything, but he now has conscience. He has a certain amount of knowledge, science. And he's put together in a context, and he's now got a conditioned reflex. And he hasn't verbalized anything yet. Now, quite a large number of people who've never verbalized anything are nevertheless full of what would be, if articulated, known antisocial behaviors. It's very important that, because when it says in the Bible, know the truth, and the truth shall make you free, not you shall make yourself free by knowing the truth shall make you free, because the truth is correct verbal form. It is said, truth is to the intellect. The intellect is the determinative faculty in which, by the use of words, allots each thing to its appropriate place. So, we have here this superficial personality which may contain many little things. Let's draw it a bit larger. There's our unconscious. There's our egoic center. Here is our zone of personalities. And we can put as many as we like in there, as many behavior patterns as we've got. Now, if we take the type of a congenital idiot, who cannot control any of his natural organic functions, if you see them in their simplest form, it helps you to understand what's going on in the so-called normal range. If you get a child that eats when he feels like eating and excretes when he feels like excreting and sleeps when he feels like sleeping, and he's incapable of speaking to you or of being modified by speech from outside, you've got a primitive type of reaction. And he has no personality. There's nothing superficial about him. The whole of his consciousness is, I eat, I sleep, I wet, I excrete, I perspire, I do so and so. That's the end of it. Only he is not verbalizing any of it. He's just doing it. Spontaneous doing. It's very nice and very primitive, but they're very difficult to handle in large numbers in society. So they tend to get put in special places by the others who suffer from a variety of inhibitory factors. So for the congenital idiot in his worst form, there is no personality and no problem. You can't have a neurotic congenital idiot. The two exclude each other. To be neurotic, you must first repress something undesirable and then go all over tears with yourself about it. So when we put in this zone of the personality as superficial, we can put in as many circles as we have environments in which we react differently. And one of the hardest things to do is react in the same way in all environments. If you can manage it, you're either a congenital idiot or a very adaptable fellow. Because if you happen to be an engineer and you work for an engineering firm, all the things you know about engineers, first we want to see this, that when it is said that if the egoic self becomes completely identified with the personality, you have a person, an individual, who is entirely superficial, and who is in very grave danger of being knocked off his stroke, because all the personalities here are merely formal reactions to an environment. So the moment you get into another environment where the stimuli coming at you are totally different, you have no reaction system established. And if you're living in your personas there, if you're living in those, you're living in a series of behavior patterns. So when the environment changes, you cannot adjust to the new stimulus quality and character, and the result is that they start disintegrating, purely mechanically, by the fact that they cannot assimilate a new energy with a new character. So your personality begins to fall to bits. I know a man now who's 70, and when he was 15, a bit of late puberty development, he felt a bit funny, and he'd been saying damn and blast and all sorts of things. Quite suddenly he felt this is wrong, and he stopped. Now, he did not know why he stopped, but he gravitated towards the Sunday school, and they explained to him that he had seen the light. Now, he thought that's a very good thing to see, so he set up a little personality there and said, that is myself, the light seer. Now, he then proceeded to move his egoic center into that personality. And he pushed it into there, and then he began to look around for something to do. And when he came to get a job, he found that he could only get a job with a man who believed that he had seen the light. So, running about saying he had seen the light, he eventually found a man who was fond of people who had seen the light, who gave him a job. And he then became a traveler, and he had a traveling personality touching his other personality. And he hadn't got any others at all. He's only got the two. His travelling personality and his light-seeing personality. Now, in the last few years, he's been brought up against certain other ideas through the instrumentality of the lady. And he's been told that people who see the light at 15 should show certain qualitative differences of behaviour. And they should be mature. And he has been told that some of his behaviour is not consistent with the light that he says he's seen. And actually he has been hit with the New Testament, the book that he saw the light in, presumably. And it has shaken him profoundly. And it has produced a schism, as they call it these days, a schism, a separation between his enlightened personality and his commercial travelling personality. And he almost doubts whether he feels free to be a commercial traveller now, because it involves a certain amount of selling of goods, which quite definitely he would not allow his daughter to wear if he had one. So now these two personalities are being pushed apart by a stimulus from outside. And while they're being pushed apart, supposing one is over there now and the other's there, and they're being held apart by some unassimilable energy. Now, he could become healthy and stop these symptoms if he took his egoic center away from those personalities and pushed it down and pushed it below there halfway, so that he was articulate in the top half of the ego center, and in the bottom half he could feel what it was that had been suppressed when he was seeing the light, because actually he was suppressing rude words. He'd been saying damn and things like that. And it's all been pushed down to the bottom. At the moment, he's entirely superficial. He's involved in two personalities, and the personalities have been separated from outside by a verbal stimulus from a lady. And because he's entirely superficial, he cannot absorb the energy of that stimulus and take it down into his individual unconscious. And then, if you are lucky, beyond this limit, this circumscription, into the absolute, which would then cause what we would call an influx of grace into him. Because when you get the absolute consciousness, that's the same as grace. Grace is simply that which is free and which solves these apparent conflicts inside. The important thing to realize is that when you say I, you should not identify and get your teeth into a personality which is on the edge of your being and is merely a reaction to an external situation. You should not allow your sense of I-ness to to equate itself with an external behaviour pattern. Because if you do, you're going to be in very serious trouble. Now, let's have a look at this question of repression of ideas again. Supposing there is the being, and we've drawn this line across him to show two aspects of his being. We remember that the whole of that being is the self. We've said before that the self is a cell with spirit, immanent. It doesn't matter whether we say S-E-L or C-E-L-L. It's the same word originally, and the same word as soul, the principle of awareness. So here is a self, and inside the self there are two aspects. An aspect of idea and an aspect of will, or form and power. And the substance of the form and the power is the self. That self is itself, the ground of its own will and its own idea. Now, idea is form, and form is circumscription. So that is the zone of definition. We've said before that nama, name, and rupa, I'll write it down below there. Rupa is form, same word as a rope, incidentally. Rope is so called because of this twisting of the pyrrha, this rotation of the threads around each other, which turns cotton and silk and other things into estura inge, string, and rope, form. Nama rupa must be seen to be one. So when we get an idea and can define it, that idea is clear, and we can use it. And we deliberately keep the will free from idea, because if we used up all our power to make it into ideas, we would have none left to move the ideas that we have made. We get the idea of another cell. Supposing a cell forgot that it had a will, necessity of keeping some of its will free to act on its ideas. So it said, I'm going to carve myself up into as many forms as I can get into this place. Now we see what happens on this diagram. When I go on drawing in this manner, we can soon see, if I go on doing like this, I will make the whole thing black, solid. Then there will be no power left over to do anything with the ideas. It will be a completely blocked being, chocker is the word, with ideas, choked with ideas, and the ideas cannot be used by that being. We can see the type of thing in an electronic brain where we charge it with data, and the data go round and round with the circulation of electrical current in it, and they can't do anything about it. They're just being data. They can't choose what to do